At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
The Team Never Quit podcast is sponsored by Navy Federal Credit Union. At Navy Federal Credit Union, they don't just serve the Navy, they also serve the Army, Marine Corps, Air Force, Coast Guard, and even the Space Force. Learn more at NavyFederal.org.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the TNQ podcast. I'm your host, Marcus Luttrell. Every week, it's my job to fire you up, to ignite the legend inside of you, and to push you to your greatness. Join me every week as I take you into my briefing room with some of the most hard-charging people on the planet. They're going to show you how to embrace the suck of life, teach you the values of working your ass off, and charge through whatever life throws at you. This is the Team Never Quit podcast. So buckle up, Buttercup.
Welcome back to another episode of the Team Never Quit podcast. My name's Andrew. I'm the producer, host with Marcus and Morgan and Melanie and the whole team, always doing this thing. If it's your first time here, welcome to the show. We have incredible guests every single week who talk about their abilities to overcome the greatest obstacles and how they deal with adversity. This week is no different. It's part two of the Marcus and Amber Capone episode. If you are just now tuning in, if you missed last week, you're going to want to go back to last week's episode. Check out last week's episode with the part one. Today, we're picking up where we left off. If you haven't already, make sure you follow us on YouTube. We've got almost 100,000 subscribers where we release new videos every single week. If you want to see what we're doing in the studio, you can watch them there. And thank you to our Patreons. Our Patreon members are who allow us to put on new shows every single week. We're so grateful for them. If you want to become a Patreon and get access to exclusive content, cool merch that you can't get anywhere else, and even a limited edition challenge coin, then you're going to want to join us at patreon.com/teamneverquit. Again, today's part two of the Marcus and Amber Capone episode. Just to give you kind of a brief background, they are the founders of Vets, a nonprofit organization that they are using to help with the growing veteran healthcare and suicide crisis in the nation. You're not going to want to miss this episode. Let's jump in.
And I'm like, you motherfucker, you're wearing that name tag. And I'm like, you, and I'm like, the shit that I'm watching, and, you know, it just, like, I snapped. I'm like, oh, I don't think I should be doing this. You know, I came to, and I got up, and one of the civilian government workers, like a GS or whatever, came over and was like, hey, man, you can't do that to the students. Like, if you're going to body slam a student, like, make sure you're down the beach away from the flagpole. Like, you can't do it right in front, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm like, yeah, totally. At a person, shouldn't have done that at all, but like it just was wrong place.
Did you explain to him like
he knew exactly. I'm like, hey, you know, yeah. He was wearing a name tag Harris, and you know, just fucking was not right at the time.
But so that's what happens when like there's not a lot of support mechanisms in place, and you take someone from multiple combat deployments and put them in a completely different environment, like without any really adequate support mechanisms. And like what you just described, you know, we were also getting that sort of like impulsivity or anger outbursts at home. And so it was like, what makes sense? You know, I almost craved like going back to the dysfunction because I knew how to live in the dysfunction. I did not know how to live with him being at home. I did not know how to have him in the house. I did not know how to co-parent with him or, you know, gauge his moods. He wasn't traveling anymore. So it was really challenging to go from, you know, that sort of a tempo to like, boop, nothing. And I think we just thought, you know, like, oh, if we have a change of scenery, things will get better. If he's not deploying, things will get better. If he gets out of the Navy, things will get better. And so he was medically retired.
Well, let's back up.
let's back up a little bit, because so I left first phase, went over to SQT for a while, and that was great. Got to teach tactics, which were, you know, I thought a little bit more my speed. So I went over to assaults and worked for some really great people, and then I took over, which was fun. But I was really struggling, and one of the head shed said, "Hey, man, I think you should go see the, like, why don't you go talk to the command, like, psychologist? Like, I think you need to. You know, just get an opinion, you know, because you're obviously, something's wrong." So I went over there, and he was like, "Yeah." He's like, "Man, these last couple of years have been," he's telling me this. He's like, "Man, these last couple of years have been crazy." He's like, "You know, you guys come in here with all the same things. Like, you're, like, there's some real shit going on here, you know?" Initially, we thought you were like, you know, what is this? But, like, you all are showing the exact same symptoms. You're going through the same things. So I think that's when I first got put on my first antidepressant.
Yeah, he said, "Guys don't even tell me their symptoms anymore. I just tell them, this is probably what you're dealing with, right? Da, 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 da." And yes. So he actually recommended that you go to NICO because you were thinking about doing a med board. And so Marcus was at NICO for 30 days and they do, you know, like a top to bottom. And he came home on like 7 or 8 prescription medications. And he had never been on a prescription. I mean, he had been hurt multiple times. He had never been on, he wouldn't even take, you know, what was prescribed in the Navy. Mm-hmm. And he's getting out of the Navy and they're like, "Goodbye, here's your, you know, 7 or 8 new prescriptions." That was in 2012.
12, Melanie, yes, yeah, mm-hmm. 2012.
So. And then he was med boarded in 2013. And we stupidly thought that we would move to LA and be a normal family.
Hold hands and skip around and everything's good after that.
Wear
right?
flower crowns.
Yeah, it was not that. So... we moved to Texas in 2014 and we made that decision based on a few things. It was like, you know, California was, it's tough to raise kids and it's very expensive. And so, I just wanted to be in a good place. I wanted to raise my kids in a really good place. I didn't know if we would last. I didn't know if he would last. I just knew I need stability, and everyone that he served with that was from Texas, like, you know, the best person ever. So, we knew schools were good. We knew cost of living was good. And we moved here. And when we moved here, the wheels completely came off. Completely came off.
Yeah. Yeah, I was at the time, I'd finished grad school at USD in San Diego and then went to work for Merrill Lynch up in Beverly Hills. So I was commuting in like 45 minutes a day from the Valley.
Sometimes up to 2 hours of traffic.
Yeah, yeah. And so it was just a shocker leaving the teams and then going to that environment especially. I think like moving down here might be one thing, but in the middle of drop you in the middle of Beverly Hills with some of those type of individuals were a different
people that have no concept of what you've been through.
It was different. It was a shocker. People I worked for were incredible. They were so good. So good. I still speak to them this day. But you know, everybody else. So I left there about a year later and, joined a firm in New York City, Fortress. But what we did is we were building two companies in North Carolina. So I started commuting from LA to Raleigh-Durham, like red eye weekly. And like, that was just impossible. I just couldn't keep up. And so they said, "Hey, move to North Carolina or, you know, or move anywhere in the country. You can run business development." So we decided to come to Texas because Amber's dad at that time just got hired as the offense coordinator at UT. They all, you know, the whole coaching staff from Louisville where Pop Watson,
Coach Pop
was coaching at the time. They came, Charlie Strong took over. Her dad came in as a coordinator, quarterbacks coach. So we were like, maybe we'll come here to Texas and, you know, it'd be good place. The kids could see Grandpa, Amber could see her dad.
And, you know, Benny Wiley?
Who is it?
Benny Wiley.
He's the strength coach at UT at that time.
Was he? Well, I'm sure we met him. We definitely
they grew up together.
When they remove the head coach, everyone goes.
I know. Oh,
yeah. 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 We definitely met him. Then.
He's at OU now.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we once he got to he came from he was at Tech with the Cowboys, then Tech, and Tennessee, and then he went to
UT.
And now he's at OU.
Yeah. Sorry. He's one of.
I grew up with him.
One of our
he was there at the same
friends.
Time.
Oh, yeah. Cool. Yeah. We'll talk about that offline then.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So anyway, so we got to Texas and I don't know. Do you want to?
So Marcus has always lived by a beach. He grew up across the street from the beach. You know, the Navy were always by a beach. And Texas was the first place that he was landlocked. And so he tried to replace surfing and, you know, being at the beach with golf. And that meant we joined a country club. And he started upping his alcohol consumption to a point that it was, you know, becoming extremely problematic. He was very unhappy.
I did get my index to down about an 8 at the time, though. So that was always good.
Dude, that's pretty good.
Is that a golf term?
That is.
So, well, there's always a silver lining.
Far from it now. Far from it.
There's always a silver lining, I guess. What a great attitude. That was quick, too. Did you see that?
Yeah.
Nice work.
Yeah. We're just trying to fill ourselves up with anything to, like,
we also
keep the engine just, like, going 100 miles an hour. We opened up the first cycle bar in the area, franchise.
We were running for, you know, to go from being in college to then all the years of insanity, you get on that type of tempo, and then how do you be normal? Mm-hmm. It's like, how do you down-regulate?
I was normal, you weren't normal.
Yet we were, you know, now we're going in like a destructive path, and we had kids. So our son was at the time 14, 15. He started acting out, you know. Our daughter was just in survival mode. Marcus and I were completely just almost at the end. But, you know, that whole thing, like, don't quit, don't quit, don't quit. So when at the height of our struggles, there was a brain autopsy released in the community. Marcus's primary diagnosis was PTSD. I had never really bought into that. I don't really buy into that for SEALs in general. I just think that it's just not like the leading concern.
I mean, except for the ones that truly have it, which there are, but the majority, right? Like learning, like operator syndrome and all this.
Yeah, sort of, I just think that you guys are just turned a little different. And so I didn't really buy into that. But when this brain autopsy was released in the community, and it was the first time that I heard about blast injury, everything made sense because all of the symptoms fit and the history fit. He had 15 years of tackle football and then 13 years as a breacher, and our life had, you know, was escalating in a downward spiral where I thought, if this is just PTSD, every year should get better, should get easier at least, and this is getting worse. And so I completely changed my approach to him, where before I was so angry and so bitter and just resentful. And, you know, I had become that wife that I didn't ever want to be. And I was very good at shaming him and guilting him and making him feel, you know, inadequate. And I completely changed my approach, and I took an approach of total grace. And I told him that if he would fight with me, I would fight for him every day for the rest of my life. But he had to fight. And I knew that, you know, the TBI piece was really concerning, and probably time was of the essence with that. I reached out to your brother during that time because I was just so frantic to help him. And I started getting him into brain clinics, and he agreed. But he was also like a ticking time bomb. You couldn't tell him anything. You couldn't talk to him about anything. He would forget to take all these medicines, and then, you know, that would cause a downward spiral. Then the medicines would cause another symptom that needed another medicine. And it was just like we were living in a tinderbox. And these brain clinics that I was getting into really weren't helping because, you know, they don't really have like a great model in terms of past the diagnostic portion. So they can tell you this is what your brain looks like, but they don't really have necessarily a great plan for what to do about it. Mm-hmm. And he was willingly going to these places and committing weeks and months of his life to you know, doing these different protocols. And he wasn't making any progress. And that was causing even more frustration and more drinking. And as things were escalating in our house, our daughter said, "How much longer do we have to do this?" And I just thought, like, I've got to choose my kids. I have to quit. And so I told my dad that I was going to quit. And I just knew if I did, I never wanted to. I never wanted to quit. And I knew if I did, that I was probably going to live the rest of my life thinking there's probably something more I could have done. My kids are going to have to live the rest of their lives without a dad. And I love him. Like, I never wanted to quit. And I remember that one of our friends had done a treatment that was very foreign, super weird in Mexico. And I thought, if nothing else, I just want to know that I tried it all. And so I convinced him to go, and absolutely changed his life and saved his life and saved our family. And immediately he's like, every guy needs this. We've got to pay this forward.
The end.
I've never heard of one person doing that where they didn't come out 100 times better, 1,000 times better. I haven't heard that
yet. It's wild. It's pretty wild.
So what was your experience like? Who did you go with? And yeah, what is the experience?
I was like Mark One Motto, guinea pig. We knew somebody before us that had gotten better. And I just thought it was crazy. You know, how can you take a pill and after a weekend be completely different from, you know, what you were before? And so, you know, and first off, so here we're talking about psychedelic-assisted therapy here, right? We're talking about psychedelic medicines. You know, all I remember from psychedelics was like what you learned maybe in college or you'd heard about, or like the 60s counterculture, and you know, these things are crazy and they're bad for you and they're bad for your brain and body. And so that's all I knew. But as I started doing research, you know, when Amber had initially mentioned this to me, everything made sense from what I read. And I couldn't, what I was trying to find is anything bad about the drugs. I don't like to call them drugs, they're actually medicines. And so there was nothing. And the only thing you could find that is was negative about it was always from an addiction website. So it was like, the addiction, you know, program of wherever, you know, and they would talk. But when you would read it, you'd go, that's false. Like, that's not even accurate. So you couldn't find anything bad about psychedelics. I'm talking about bad for, like, bad for the body, bad for the brain, heart, liver.
They're physiologically relatively safe. I mean, most of them. Ibogaine has a contraindication, you know, cardiac.
But outside of that, like, I hate to say it, but they're actually good for you. They're actually good for your brain, physiologically.
In small microdoses.
In both. They both do different things. Mm-hmm. And there's still a ton of research over the next couple of years that we're going to find out more. Mm-hmm. But yeah, initial research is showing that microdoses are definitely building up, physiologically changing the brain into a positive direction. Hero doses or large doses are what our guys are going through for this kind of life-changing experience, because it's hitting both, you know, spiritually, psychologically, and then physiologically. So it kind of covers everything.
The difference, though, I think, with if you're at home and you hear someone mm-hmm. doing a psychedelic, they're doing it to get high and, you know, have fun, basically numb themselves or whatever. What we're talking about here is actually healing. Mm-hmm.
It's a therapeutic use of psychedelics.
Yeah, it's for therapy. It is for the purpose of healing.
100%. Now, there are a lot of people that are doing it by themselves that are doing it for 100% therapeutic reasons also. There, of course, are many that are doing it for whatever recreational use. But I am also hearing how many are doing it by themselves for the therapeutic use because they don't have access mm-hmm. to it anywhere. So they're just either finding a guide or someone who knows a little bit about it, or someone who actually knows a lot about it, and they're just going and doing it and doing the experience because they literally are trying to find any answer.
Mm-hmm. So we jumped the gun a little bit.
Yeah.
Tell us about your experience. You go down to Mexico, or where did you go, and what was that?
Yeah. So I went to a reputable clinic in Mexico. After again, like this was a year. I mean, Amber had been trying to get me to go for a year. And I wouldn't go again because I just thought it was nuts. Like I grew up, you know, probably like you, Marcus, Marcus Luttrell, you know, drinking some beer and, you know, whiskey, whatever. But like drug use was like, to me, that was like, I didn't do that. Like we were the kids from Long Island that went to school in Queens. We went to Catholic school in Queens. We were the Long Island kids that just drank beer. All the other kids were like smoking pot and doing all this other stuff. And we thought it was crazy. Right. So that's how I was. I said, you know, this stuff seems nuts to me.
And to me, because I grew up in a very conservative Christian family. Like for me, that was the last thing that I wouldn't have even considered it had this other team guy not shared with me. And he and his wife knew how much Marcus was struggling, and they, you know, like the community always does, wanted to help. Mm-hmm. And so that same group one medical officer that I just said, you know, didn't even have to ask guys about their symptoms. I worked with him and the other SEAL to get Marcus help. But for the longest time, he was like, no, that's crazy. No. He wanted a Western approach. He wanted to go to a doctor that was wearing a lab coat and had a stethoscope and could prescribe medicine. And, you know, brain clinics were like as crazy as he was willing to get to go. But when you get to a point where you've tried everything, you are literally so desperate. I was so desperate to save him, us, our family. It was like, yeah, whatever. It's all out the window.
I went to 5 brain clinics. I actually went to one of the top, and I don't want to talk about it here, one of the top in the world. I mean, still the same. Like, not, they were all the same. You know, somebody, thank goodness it wasn't coming out of our pocket. You know, all these foundations were set up, but each one was, you know, 15,000 to 30,000 a pop, right? For a week or 2 weeks or whatever it was. I mean, think about the amount of money that was spent and still, like, got nowhere. And so, after a year of that, I was just tired. I was like, done. I was done. I would have tried anything. Like, okay, this sounds crazy, but I just want to get better.
And what were your symptoms? So anyone listening might.
So, couldn't remember anything, couldn't focus. Extremely impulsive. You know, I would fly off the handle. Depression was horrible. You know, I couldn't get out of bed literally for days. And here I am, like full time, like executive role. I'd stay in bed for days on end, hysterical crying for no reason, crying at random places throughout the day, national anthem, start bawling my eyes out, you know, sitting in Starbucks. It didn't matter. Like, it was just weird. The stuff that was going on was just, this is not normal. Like, who does this, right? You know, because of that, all of that, you know, couldn't sleep. You know, if I got a headache, it wasn't an average headache. It was like a horrible headache.
Oh, he'd wake up in the middle of the night screaming.
You know,
I'd have to run to get 800 milligram ibuprofen.
You know, violent dreams, which completely stopped after which is crazy because I've had those for so long. They just literally went away overnight. Because of all these things, and again, I wasn't getting, which I felt better, like Amber said, I was getting worse. I was ready to do anything at that time. I had just left another brain clinic. I got out of there more pissed off than I went in. They were doing some TMS work, and I think they would cranked it up so high the whole time. I remember telling them, like, hey, this hurts. Like, am I supposed to feel like someone's like chiseling my nose, you know? Like, so anyway, I had just very unlucky or very shitty outcomes, you know, from all these different places that I was going to. And I was just ready. And I finally just said, you know what, Amber, I'll go do this. Number one, like, I'm tired of arguing with you that there's something wrong with me, because I was fine. I would have tried anything at that time. So that's kind of what got me to commit. And so I went by myself. I learned a little bit about the medicine.
You went with the other team guy.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. The medicine was called ibogaine. It's a very strong alkaloid that's extracted from the iboga root, which is the plant. It's a shrub in Western Africa that's grown. They've used it for literally centuries, like many Native American, you know, have used peyote and you know, for rites of passage and for spiritual healing. And, you know, so when you start reading about it, it all makes sense. This medicine of choice was Ibogaine, arguably one of the strongest, probably the strongest psychedelic on the planet. You go for a 12-hour, roughly 8 to 12-hour experience, maybe 4 to 6 hours of like peak, really intense, it's like an awakened dream state.
How is it administered?
It's body weight. So the medicine is by body weight. You take it in like a capsule format.
So it's a pill.
It's a pill, yeah. So if you weigh, you know, 230 pounds, or if you weigh, you know, 100 pounds, your doses are going to be.
I wish I weighed 100
pounds. They're,
you like how I did that, right? I was like 100 pounds.
They
maybe 110.
They're dehydrating the root, or they're extracting. You don't know.
Well, Dr. Capone, in all my experience at med school, no, I believe the shrub is ground, the root into a powder. But then, like I said, however they take out alcohol, like CBD or CBN from mm-hmm. cannabis, mm-hmm. Or THC, like just that, that's what they do with Iboga, and it's Ibogaine, and I think there's about 13 other or 12 other alkaloids. I may be wrong on that. But there are other alkaloids in Iboga that are just as good for different properties, addiction. So Ibogaine is one of the like leading, if not the strongest drug on the planet for addiction.
Yeah, because I've Googled it, and when I Google it, most websites come up, pretty much all websites that come up are for addiction facilities. Yeah,
it's incredible. Like most of the team guys that have been treated, half of them come out and never want to touch alcohol ever again. Some of them just completely stop drinking forever, literally from one dose. Now, not everyone's like that, but again, this is the type of things that are happening. So it's super exciting that you know these medicines are out there. So you take the pill, you put eye shades on, you put like noise canceling headphones on, and you basically are listening to like a meditative type of soft kind of spa music for the next 12 hours, and you're lying in like a bed. And there's a therapist there, like a psychotherapist, a coach who's...
So like middle of the day, at night?
Yeah, sort of ceremonial. So like as the sun's going down, a little fire ceremony. They talk a little bit about the medicine and like how many thousands of years these medicines have been used to kind of, you know, extract the demons, right? Like heal, cleanse the person. And then you get taken, you know, you take the pill, you go in the room. And like I said, sun's going down. So maybe 5, 6 o'clock, 7.
Are there other people?
So
there wasn't for him, but what we're,
yeah, we can, I think we'll talk about the program now, like kind of how it's more.
I'm just trying to picture it.
No,
in my
it's
head.
Good. Yeah.
He was treated alone.
Yeah. Just picture me as the guinea pig.
Uh-huh. Like, yeah.
Held together by glue and tape and 550.
Is your friend, the other team guy that was there, is he in the same room with you?
No. You're by yourself.
Okay.
But you are with your therapist, mm-hmm. because that therapist is not just a therapist or coach. It's a psychedelic assisted therapist. It's someone who understands psychedelics, has been through treatment and training, has guided, you know, thousands of visits before that. And so it's like your sensei, it's like your master that, you know, whatever you're experiencing, they have the answer. They know. So this person helps guide you through that experience, because some of them are gnarly. I mean, they're going deep into some trauma. And if you don't understand that, you could be like a wounded soul. And so that person there is helping you like through the experience. Like, why did I just talk to my best friend that I watched die on the battlefield? You know, and it's like, well, you know, that's obviously that is a sticking point in your subconscious that's affecting you. And, you know, the drug wanted you to see that, you know, and kind of helps you, like coaches you through the experience, because you go, you see stuff from childhood, you see stuff from war.
Do you mind telling what you saw?
I mean, everything. I mean, I saw a little bit of childhood, not really. Like, so I don't think my childhood was like super effective of what was going on. I think everything happened for me was more probably, you know, maybe TBI related. A lot of, you know, stuff that happened in the teams. I definitely did see a lot of, there was a lot of like fighting and, you know, gory, like, you know, knife fighting and shooting and just like weird type of like images and those type of things. I did talk to myself when I talked to my dad who passed. But the thing, you really think you're there. You're going through this like real awake. You feel like you're in an awakened dream state because you are awake. You're not sleeping. You can pull the eye shades up and you're like, oh, okay, I'm grounded. I'm here. You know, I'm not in this hell or wherever this thing is taking me. You know, some people feel heat, right? Like they are in quote unquote hell and they're feeling heat and they're sweating. I mean, my heart rate was jumping because you're hooked up to a heart rate monitor. My heart rate was jumping up pretty high because I was like, whatever I was experiencing was really affecting me, you know? But here's what the doctor told me. He said, as you go through this experience and you're going to deal with all these things, it's going to feel like, you know, make believe you have a backpack on with, you know, a ton of bricks in it, like 100 pounds of bricks. And as you go through this journey, it's going to feel like bricks are starting to just like get thrown out on the floor. And by the end of your journey, you have an empty backpack. You're light, you're free, you know, you're clean. And so that's exactly what it was like. You go through these hard experiences, you're crying and you're facing shit again that you really don't want to, but it cleanses you. It's like everything else. You know, do you want to bury those things deep down inside and keep them in, you know, and deal with them however people deal with. And a lot of times it's bad. Or you go through this journey and you're dealing with them through this, you know, through this medicine experience, and you face the challenge, you face the demon, and then it goes away. It's like you're like exercising it, you're cleansing yourself. I don't know if I'm doing a good job, but you know, I tell people
it was like
oh God, I vomited for hours.
Like while it's happening?
Yeah, it was terrible. And the vomiting is a lot of, you know, they call it purging. You're purging through bad traumatic experiences.
They literally have like a trash can.
Oh yeah.
Apparently puking is good in psychedelic therapy because you are literally getting this energy and darkness and ick out of your system, out of your soul, out of your body. It's just very cleansing. I guess.
And which is also when you're like, you're getting rid of like toxins.
Like it's detoxifying.
Yeah.
So the guy that was with him was keeping me posted during the experience, and you know, he was really struggling and I was feeling this. I actually texted him and said, I'm feeling something like, is he okay? And he was like, well, he's really struggling right now. He's puked for 8 hours or something. And I was like, oh my gosh, that's so bad. He's like, no, that's so good.
So do you have an IV that's hydrating
mm-hmm.
you?
No, but you have fluids there and electrolytes and you could sip and things like that. But like I said, you are being monitored.
I think that the guys going down now do have an IV.
Okay.
Yeah. At least inserted. So if they needed fluids, they could have it.
Yeah.
But
like going back to your question, Melanie, I mean, yeah, I was... You know, I saw a lot of, you know, bad wartime images that I was, you know, I was there again, like, you know, like duking it out, you know, seeing, you know.
Was it like a highlight reel of something that happened or was it?
Yes.
Okay. So it's you basically went back in time mm-hmm. to something that really happened. It wasn't like you're like a dream where you might be somewhere, you might not know, you know.
But both.
Okay.
So it's both. And the dreams resembled, like, just like when you have a dream, they're like, you know, they're weird, right? They're mm-hmm. just
like
not
a version of the dream.
They're not normal. You're floating, you're flying, or you're just all types of, yeah, I think that's a good version of the truth. But then you are seeing actual stuff.
Actual footage of mm-hmm. what you've been through.
Yes.
Ibogaine is typically described as that, like a rewind or a Rolodex of someone's life, and they're pretty traumatic memories.
Yeah, and then there's parts of the experience, and there's all different phases of it. Like there's phases of the experiences depending on, like, and so you go through, you know, there was a phase of where it looked like I literally, my brain was defragging. So like it was filing everything that happened. So like as I experienced these individual experiences, then I experienced all of them at one time, but it looked like they were just getting filed, like they're just getting put in a folder.
I've already explained that the same way.
It's remarkable. Like, it literally flicking through. It's remarkable what, you know, and then the puking, you know, and then the therapist trying to explain to me as this is going on, you know, and then you.
He had no idea what he was signing up for. Remember that.
So did you want to, like, at any point, want to just take the shades off and get up and walk around?
You can't. No.
You don't do that.
No, you're messed up. I mean, first off, it throws off your equilibrium, so you're pretty much in bed. If you have to go to the restroom, that's Charlie snorting.
Just don't let anybody think of that for making.
He just wants to let everybody know he's here. You get up to go to the restroom, you have to be walked there. Your balance is all off.
Yeah.
And so, like, they walk you to the restroom, but you don't want to move. But you do want to take them off sometimes because it gets too intense. Like, you really feel like you're there. And so that's hard. You know, I mean, we're talking about guys that have talked to their, you know, their dead buddies that they served, you know, they were with on deployment, having full-on conversations with them and saying, hey, man, it's okay. I'm good. You can move on now. You know, these are the things that you experience. So when it's done, besides feeling like complete crap because you just threw up for a bunch of hours and you just experienced shit that you can't even believe that you just experienced. You know, as you start to get some food in you and some water, I started Friday night. I slept all the way to, like.
I saw you on Saturday night.
Saturday night? Mm. Okay. So I slept all day Saturday.
But you were, you know, I saw you came down the hall. You were in the room for 5-10 minutes and then you went back to bed and then I saw you the next day.
Okay, yeah. So I was out of it. So basically Sunday, say I came through, started feeling better. But I just felt like, you know, you just feel a glow when you're done. You're just going.
He was glowing.
You're like, oh, this is good. Like, this is definitely, there's something here.
I felt like seeing him then was like seeing him before he was a SEAL. And there was just this, like, innocence back. There was like a happiness and a Marcus was always so cool. He was like cooler than cool, and he had become wound so tight, and he was just like, whew, back.
Did you have any spiritual experience? Like, did you
absolutely
feel like God was telling you it was okay or whatever?
Yeah, I felt like I was, you know, with God the whole time, you know, through that, you know, and I points of, like, actually floating up to heaven and just being there and seeing, like, you know, white lights and, like, hugging and, like, you know, love. And it was just like, it was just a roller coaster of things, you know, for me. Nothing was ever, for me, I didn't go through it like in stages of some people actually went through like different stages where they just kept going through different stages of lives. And me, I felt like it was more of a collage, you know, of things thrown at me. And so I would, you know, I'd have like this, I don't know if it was like angel or white, but like I could picture it now. And it was just, you know, again, it's your, you know, your mind just saying, you know, like, hey, you're good. You're free. Like, you know, I got you. I took all the rocks out of the bag and you're good now. And that's, you know, again, our minds are, you know, there's still a lot to explore. And so I think that was the part where it was telling me that, hey, you're healed, you're good, and you know, hopefully you don't have to go visit any of that stuff again.
That's a common theme that's coming out, you know, that we're hearing, and we can get into when we went into action and got real serious about paying this forward. But for those that we sponsor going through, they've said the same things. There's general themes that come out, which is like, you know, I feel free. I want to live again. There is a God. We're all connected. And Ibogaine has been described a certain way, a Rolodex of one's life. And then the second medicine that's used is more of like a spiritual molecule. And so guys have described feeling like they literally died and they've come back, and like what they're describing is an ego death. So, you know, ego in the teams is necessary, but ego, that same ego for the rest of your life could actually be a detriment. So that, you know, the death of the ego is allowing them to really live a vulnerable and authentic life from that point forward. Not that it's a one and done, not that it's a miracle cure, but it clears so much space for healing. There have been guys that have come through and turned from their faith, had no faith, full on like atheist. And, you know, they're like, no, there's a God. No, that I want to know more about this. And so the healing that we're seeing is happening on a psychological level, whether you want to call that PTSD, repressed trauma, whatever, and a physiological level, because everyone is reporting massive cognitive improvement. I've seen it. I mean, that's the most incredible thing for me. There's an addiction piece because Ibogaine is so profound in addressing addiction. So if guys are coming in with alcohol issues or opioid issues from injuries in the military, that's no longer an issue. And then there's a spiritual healing that's happening. And for me, that's probably the most important thing and the most incredible thing. As a Christian, I had a really hard time wrapping my head around what is this, because I have never done a psychedelic. I'm completely opposed to drugs. I don't feel like this is that, though. But it took a long time for me to get there. After Marcus came back, I was like, what just happened? I was so grateful, but my mind was blown, because we were in such survival fallout mode leading into this that it was like, what have we just done? I was so desperate, I didn't even really think about it. And now, you know, this our whole life shifted overnight. I was working with a Christian therapist at the time, and I was almost afraid to tell her, like, she would judge me. But I did, because I really needed help in working through it. And she was able to point out some key things for me, which is like, at the most basic level, what did you pray for? This. I prayed for this. Like, this is an answer to my prayer. She's like, what was his intention going in? You can literally abuse anything. Was his intention pure? Yes, he just wanted to heal. And she's like, this is a plant. God put this plant on earth. Who are you to say how it's used? You know, you, and I realized I was conditioned to believe that big pharma or medicine had an answer. The white lab coats had the answer, but a plant is a drug. And I'm like, oh, wait, I'm smarter than that.
Don't take this one, take this one.
Right, yes. Right.
You know what I mean? It's a medicine's medicine.
Right. And then, what was the other? There were a few different points along the way that I was like, oh, yeah. And she said, and what's happening in your community? Because by that point, like a few of our friends had gone, and she's like, what's happening in your community? How is that bad? If you're giving, you know, if families are whole again, like if you want to go from a Christianity perspective, like good and evil, good is that there's restoration. Evil is that there's destruction. There's plenty of destruction. And this is providing restoration. Tell me how that's bad. And I was like, oh, yeah, you're right. Okay, I'm 1,000% behind this now.
Yeah, so, you know, when I came out, the first thing I said to Amber was, like, we got to pay this forward. I don't think I said that. I just said, hey, we got to spread the word.
You said, this is exactly what the guys need.
Yeah. Yeah, I was like, we have to tell everybody about this. This is not like 100% what the guys need. And that kind of started it November of 2017. Fast forward, probably trying to get this together. Middle of what, 2018 is when you really started to kick it into gear? Or?
Yeah, we were approached by a donor in December. Marcus was treated on Veterans Day, ironically, which I think was super cool. But the following month, a donor approached us and said, I want to give to a veteran organization. Can you recommend one? And Marcus said, well, actually, I have a buddy who's struggling, and I had a treatment last month, and it saved my life. Like, you could save someone's life. And she was totally on board, and so she gave us a donation, and we were able to pay that forward with helping, like, three or four guys right off the bat.
How much is it?
It's not expensive. The grants that we provide, all in with coaching and travel and everything, are right around $5,000 per veteran. So, I think she wrote like a $20,000 check or something. And we just gave that to the doctor that had treated Marcus and then referred some of our friends. And we were very reluctant because, you know, the community is so built on ego that it's like no one can admit that they're struggling. There's a real stigma with that. And so we were just comfortable telling people that we trusted and seeing what their outcomes were. And their outcomes were good. So then it's like, okay, well, I'm very strategic. And so my goal was like, okay, let's let 12 months pass and 12 guys have the same experience. That way we know, is it going to work for more than just him and his friends? And is it going to last? It definitely felt too good to be true. And so at the 11 and a half month mark, before we were, you know, comfortable talking about it, one of my best friend's husbands took his life. He was active duty, 21-year SEAL. And I was sitting in his funeral, and I just was started shaking uncontrollably. And I like instantly downloaded, which I kind of totally bypassed the part, my part in this, which was really leaning back into my faith. It was something that I was raised with, but not necessarily like fully relying upon. I wasn't taking time for God. I was giving God my time when it was convenient. And I completely changed everything about my faith and my walk in faith. And when things really started to get bad for us, I started to dive in. And I was just in my Bible. I would sit for hours every single day is how I started my day. And sometimes it was 20 minutes. Sometimes it was 3 hours. Sometimes I was screaming, crying, writing. I just sat and I just learned to be still. And as I was becoming stiller and stiller, my life was spinning more and more out of control. But I was gaining a peace that I couldn't even put into words. And I was getting, you know, these feelings of like, there's like relief coming. There's something big coming. But I had to stop and listen. And so I was sitting in Chad's funeral, and that, you know, one of those feelings came over me. And when it's God, you know immediately. And the feeling that I had as I looked around this chapel that we've been in a million times for war funerals, and there were all the same guys there, and they had more medals, and they had more gray hair, and they looked like hell. And I thought, this is it. This is going to be the next wave of funerals for this community. And if we don't speak out and we don't find the courage and the conviction to share something that could work, then we're really doing a disservice to a community that means the world to us. And I just said, like, that's it. I'm going to, as uncomfortable as it is to share this level of vulnerability, I have to, you know. And so from Chad's funeral forward, the next goal was 100 SEALs, or I'm sorry, 100 Special Operations soldiers beyond SEALs. I mean, most of our grant recipients are SEALs, but, and research. Because everyone says, like, oh, anecdotal stories are great, but where's the data? And I knew that that would be coming. So we did it. We did 100 in research, and everything looked great. And so in 2019, we pulled the trigger. We formed our own foundation. We raised money to support other veterans, special operations veterans, seeking psychedelic-assisted therapies. But in full transparency, 95% or more of them are seeking the same protocol that Marcus did. And the results have been phenomenal.
How many to date?
Over 300 to date.
Oh, my gosh. I knew it was a lot. I mean, just not being involved at all with anything that y'all are doing, we hear about it a lot. And we've been hearing about it for years. Oh, my gosh. I mean, I've known about it, but I've always also known that it's kind of like...
I know when you were out there and when you went through it.
Yeah. I mean, we've heard everything about this for so long, but it's always been that, like, we knew it was undercover.
We've tried to keep it very...
And so you only under the tell, radar. Like, people... Like, I've only shared with people that I've seen, like, extremely... Especially the wives, you know, we vent about our husbands or whatever. But...
I have no doubt.
We never talk about y'all.
We don't.
And I'll be like, have you heard about, so there's this thing. Have you heard about that? And then the next thing I know, they're like, oh, so my husband went and did this. And we have not heard anything bad. I've heard of two people going that didn't want to go, but their wives made them go.
Yeah, that's tough.
That's not good.
And I think that does need to be shared too, because if the person going through it isn't ready, it's not going to work. And that's what I saw with two people that I know, that the wives were just at their last straw, and they're like, you have to do this. And so the husbands went to appease the wife, but they personally weren't ready.
Yeah.
And they came back saying it didn't work, whatever. You know, they didn't say anything bad about the experience. They just said it didn't work. But when you know about the experience and you know you have to be open to this, So don't waste your time, you know, and don't waste the funds. You know, if the person isn't ready to go, then there's no reason.
Yeah, it took Marcus a year. And I don't think I was at the point where I was necessarily giving like him a full-blown ultimatum, but I certainly, he knew that I was on my last leg. And I think he could feel that. And so he agreed to do it. But I never would have told him, you know, you have to do this.
Mm-hmm. And I wanted to get better. So as much as, you know, I didn't care. I would have done, I mean, I would have done anything to get better. And so I think, you know, if individuals, they have to be ready to heal to go do this, because like those two individuals, they just, they didn't even want to know about it. Mm-hmm. When we were talking about it earlier, you know, the person has to be ready, has to be open, has to be willing, set and setting, like they got to want it. Mm-hmm. And then they're going to, you know, then they're going to change their life to the better.
But literally out of probably at least 100 people, I'm not exaggerating, that we know that have done it, those were two instances that just, and the reason I even bring those up, I'm not trying to bash it, is because I want people to know it won't work. If you're not open to
it. I wouldn't say necessarily that it wouldn't work, because Marcus didn't have any sort of preparation or really understanding of what he was getting into. And even though he was willing, it still wasn't the level of preparation that we provide now. So we're choosing, the demand is so outrageous now that we have to be, you know, very... We have to choose, you know, who gets these precious funds, because it's very difficult to fundraise for something like this and to meet the demand that is exploding. Because like we've been saying, the community is so great about taking care of each other. Everyone who comes through knows 2 to 5 others that are struggling and need help like yesterday. So it's made this effort just absolutely grow by leaps and bounds. And I think that those that are coming in for funding and answering, you know, questions like, I am totally at the end of my rope and I need help and I know how important preparation is and I'm willing to do integration and I want to make lifestyle changes and I really want my family to work. Those are the people that are getting the funding because they're willing to put in the work. It's the guys that come in and they're like, I don't know what this is. My buddy said to do it. They're not going to get nearly as much from it.
Yeah. And I think it's special too. I think this is like a special, you know, it's like a, what did somebody I worked with once told me, like, going to war is a privilege. It's not like I'm entitled to go to war. Like, no, that's a privilege. Like, you got to earn that shit. I think this is, you know, I wanted to do this for the guys that, like you and the guys that we worked with that deserve it and, like, need it. And, like, they deserve to go there first because, you know, they fought for this country. They worked their ass off. They bled. They lost friends or lost their families or kids or whatever. Like, those are the guys that need to go first. So like we're here, we can only offer up so much, but I think the more we now we start talking about it and the more politicians we can get involved and the more that people know about stuff that's out there that really works, then we can treat a larger population. So we can, instead of treating over 300, maybe we could treat, you know, 300,000 or 3 million eventually, right?
So how are you sending like 3 guys a month, or is this like a weekly thing? How
we typically support 4 to 6 guys per weekend, 2 to 3 weekends per month. So between 30 and 40 per quarter. We were able to reach 110 in 2020. We were projected to reach 125 in 2021. And, you know, fundraising is the biggest ongoing challenge with that. So it's really forced us out of our comfort zone. I mean, we definitely don't love, you know, the PR tour of highlighting the struggles that we've gone through. But when you hear on Monday morning, you know, the thank yous and the this saved my life and the letters and emails from spouses and photos of the families, you just... I will not quit.
Yeah. You know, one of the, one of our very close friends who helped initially fundraise with us, wanted us to take a different route, but you know, we wanted to fund our guys and get them better. That was our goal. And now, like we said, we've funded over 300 guys. But their thing was, do you want to keep treating or funding individuals to go get better, or are you guys going to get out there and start speaking and educating and bringing research in to treat, like I said, you know, 3 million or 300 million? So now this year, you know, we're taking that advice. I think we've funded enough individuals to get treatment, and then
we're going to continue that.
That'll continue. But now we need to talk about it like we're doing here. Like I said, it was a bit uncomfortable. I'm starting to get better about it. But it's, you know, I think the more we talk, the more we get up out in the open, the more people learn, the more this is going to spread. And so I could get past the, well, I don't want to talk about the teams. Now I'm doing it for like, no, this is not about you. This is about everybody else. So
what about the wives? Like, the guy goes, he has this awesome experience. And meanwhile, the wife has had her own trauma of, I mean, like you were saying, like you were at your wit's end. You were at the point where you had accepted, like, okay, I need to change my whole mindset. But some of the wives that are still super resentful and in that anger stage, and the guy comes home from that, how does she be supportive of him?
I would say my advice from my own personal experience, I personally just let God change my heart. And I feel like, you know, seeing Marcus through eyes of grace wasn't necessarily something that I would have been capable of doing on my own. I really had to pray about that and be intentional about that. And then when I was able to see him through eyes of grace as, you know, a child of God, as someone who really wanted to be better, as, you know, someone's dad, someone's son, and not, you know, my annoying husband.
Yeah.
What?
it shifted my perspective in a way that allowed me to think differently and to problem solve differently. And so I realize that not every spouse is going to be in that same situation. But I always think it's a good place to start. I think that starting with myself and working on my own heart and my own attitude, that was the only way I was able to get to him.
Mm-hmm.
And for the spouses that just really aren't there yet, we do provide resources for them through vets. So we provide at minimum a group coaching call where there's a therapist on, I'm on most of the time. And those happen once a week. And then we also provide spouse grants. So I feel like psychedelics are a vessel to higher levels of awareness and consciousness. And so some people, even people in the community, have ignorantly said, how can Amber run a psychedelic nonprofit if she's never done a psychedelic? Well, I've loved someone who I almost lost and was saved by this. So that in and of itself is enough. I attained a level of awareness and grace over the course of years that I was really working on myself. Psychedelics take you there almost overnight. They definitely do something on a physiological level, which is really compelling for TBI. But, you know, it's a lot of work. And for the spouses who are trying to support their husbands the best they can, it can be problematic when he comes home and he's done the work. He's taken the rocket ship. And it can cause issues with, like, wait a minute, now I want to talk about the past. Wait a minute, now I feel like I'm not in survival mode because you're stable. Now I'm going to fall apart. Or just a complete, don't understand what he's just gone through and she's, you know, feeling left behind. So we try to provide resources that, you know, allow them to come alongside their spouse and not make this, you know, use this as an opportunity to really catapult into a better relationship.
Do you recommend people going back?
Absolutely. I think this is something that, to each his own. So each person's going to react differently. Some people can do this, you know, one time and be better for the rest of their lives. I mean, there's a lot of people right now that are going down to Peru and Costa Rica and doing, you know, ayahuasca retreats and it's changed their life forever and they don't need to go back. I know others that go down there once a quarter. I know others that go down twice a year. What I've realized is I think I need something like this once a year. And again, to each his own. This is a tool to help you get better. You can't go to the gym one time and work out, you know, for a month and be in shape for the rest of your life. You need to work at it. regularly. So I think this is something that you need to work at regularly. I don't think you need to do psychedelics every weekend, but I do think if it's, you know, twice a year or four times a year where you're going for like a full, like a reset, it's perfect.
Or once a year or every other year. Yeah, I mean, who knows?
It's up to the person.
There's also the physiological component of this, which psychedelics have primarily been researched and known for their therapeutic use. So dealing with emotional issues. There's a real physiological element here that was immediately noticeable for me with all the TBI concerns. I just wanted to threw this as a Hail Mary to try to buy some time to see if this, you know, would work or if this is the last thing I'm going to try, then I know I've done it all. But what ended up happening was this healing across this myriad of areas in his life. And the most profound one for me was the cognitive improvement. So I was trying to get anyone to listen to me about, the cognition piece. And I reached out to, I was connected with a researcher at Stanford. And I said, like, something happened to his brain. I know it did. And he believed me. And so we're launching a study with Stanford this spring to look at the physiological component as it relates to blast injury and TBI.
So 30 individuals.
So if somebody wants to find out how to donate, contribute to the organization or all this, where how do they find you?
Vetsolutions.org.
www.vetsolutions.org.
Social media.
Yeah.
Is that your social media handle?
No, it was taken. So it's Veteran Solutions on Instagram.
Just like to throw out about the maintenance and going back, I think that's with anything. Like Marcus goes to Exos every year. Every single year, it's his routine. In February, he goes and has a physical rehab, and it's like his kicks off his year of reset. And he does stem cells too. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people think you get stem cells once and you're done, but it's like anything with your body, because your body is always changing. Right. You have to maintain that. You have to keep going back.
Marcus, I'm interested in both, so let's talk about that offline.
Mind, body, and spirit. I mean, you bust your body up, your mind will have to catch up with that, right. So it's off, so your spirit will shut down while you're doing both that. So the minute you, when those start catching, you feel it. Mm-hmm. Like you feel like, I've been in the gym working out, your mental game is so focused, and then that's when that opens up, and you're like, oh.
Right.
Yeah.
So when the vessel gets hit, sometimes the spirit will back. So it's like, I'll let this thing heal up. Because otherwise, we'll just keep going.
Yeah.
Won't take time to, and we'll burn this thing out. But thank you all so much for coming out here.
Yeah. Thank you.
Cool story. I mean, good like time. I said, we've heard, Marcus and I have heard about it for years. And we've always known to keep it on the down low. So we don't talk about it.
It was good. We could talk now about Fight Club now. So yeah. That's good.
That's right. About time, right?
I'm with you. Like, I was always... Marcus and I were both raised, like, never touch a drug, never do anything like that. Both came from Christian homes, and I would have never believed in it if it wasn't for one of our friends that we're very close with that did it. And I saw a 100% change in his, really in every aspect of his life. Like, you could even see it in his eyes that he was a different person.
Yeah.
And it's been years since he has done his first one, and he's still going strong, hasn't drank, hasn't done any pills or anything. And
it's really remarkable.
It really is. It's crazy. Right?
How is that bad?
It's like a brain surgery.
Yeah.
In a weekend.
That's wild.
Yeah.
It really is. What y'all are doing is amazing work, and we're really proud of y'all. And I know it's not easy to share such a vulnerable side of your life and story, but thank you for sharing it on this podcast, and we hope that your story helps a whole bunch of other people.
Thanks for having us. It's been so much fun.
But
what an incredible interview we had today with Marcus and Amber. This two-part was such a great story. What they're doing for veterans, special forces, is just super incredible. It's fascinating, and I'm just so grateful we were able to share their story. Thank you guys for checking back every single week, listening to the episode, sharing it with friends, subscribing. We appreciate all of those things. It helps us spread the message of that never quit mentality, that never quit attitude. If you want to follow us, you can follow us on social media, teamneverquit.com/social, where you can find all of our social media profiles. You guys should definitely consider subscribing on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, CastBox, wherever you get your podcasts. That way you'll get notified the moment we drop new episodes. We've got an incredible lineup of people that we're going to have, and we're even in the talks about releasing some brand new shows, some brand new hosts, and some content that will just continue to add to this library of the entire Team Never Quit community. We want you guys to be the first to know about it. Join us at patreon.com/teamneverquit for access to exclusive gear, live streams, some exclusive merch like a unique limited edition challenge coin. All of those things are awesome. Again, thank you guys so much for supporting this show every single week. If you'd like to share your story and tell us how the show has impacted you, you can do that at teamneverquit.com/podcast. There's a share your story button right up in the navigation. Thank you guys again for checking it out. We'll see you guys next week.